You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abu Naima here with my colleague Nora Barrows Friedman. David Sheen is an investigative journalist from Canada who is based in Haifa. He has written for many outlets and has contributed many important stories to the Electronic Intifada since 2012. Since the start of the Israeli genocide in Gaza in particular, Sheen has authored, sometimes jointly with me, I'm proud to say, critically important exposés of Israel's lies and cover-ups of what happened on October 7th. On October 15, 2023, we published what, in my opinion, is one of the most significant pieces that I've worked on in the past 2 years. The headline is, Israeli forces shot their own civilians, kibbutz survivor says. That survivor, Yasmin Porat, gave the first detailed account of how Israeli forces fired on the home of Pessi Cohen in kibbutz Be'eri, massacring a number of Israeli civilians and Palestinian fighters inside. And it was perhaps the first major revelation of how Israel killed many of its own people that day. In July last year, David Sheen and I wrote about how the Israeli army has tried to cover up the deliberate tank shelling of Pessi Cohen's house, even though it was clear that there were Israeli civilians inside who would be, and in fact were, incinerated. That cover-up was apparently intended to protect Barak Hiram, the brigadier general who ordered the attack. There were many other such incidents of Israel using massive and indiscriminate fire against its own people on October 7th, or explicitly invoking the so-called Hannibal Directive, an Israeli military doctrine that allows the use of lethal force to stop Israelis being taken captive, even if it means knowingly killing them. While it was known that Israel had used the Hannibal Directive previously against its own soldiers, October 7th is the first time it was used, and on a wide scale, against Israeli civilians as well as soldiers. Our colleague Esawen Stanley has, of course, reported on that for the Electronic Intifada, as well as on this live stream. As for David Sheen, his most recent piece was published by the Electronic Intifada on April 30th. It's headlined, The Vach Brothers, Israel's First Family of Genocide. We're going to talk about that and other developments right now with David Sheen. David, welcome to the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Good to see you, David.
Yeah, we've spoken about you many times on the live stream, but and of course you've been on the Electronic Intifada podcast, but we're really excited to have you on the live stream now, David. Before we get into the discussion, let's watch this short video clip together.
Sure.
Is the destruction then? I'm sorry. Why is the destruction?
This destruction
it looks like a
was
more like a
cause of our tanks attack.
Fired on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they were blocked in these houses and we need to conquer back the whole settlement. And okay. It couldn't be happened without the tanks.
So how many were here, and then how many survived?
No one survived from this house. From other buildings, we rescued many. Where you stand exactly, were lying two couples, two men, two women, handcuffed. And inside this house were another 15 burned people, among them 8 babies. They concentrated them, and they killed them, and they burned them.
Did you see?
I evacuated them.
So, David, that was a clip from a video report you made for the Electronic Intifada last year, and it's also people can watch it in your latest article. And it shows Colonel Golan Vach speaking to journalists in the days after October 7, 2023. Give us the basics here. Who is Golan Vach and what is he talking about there? What's the significance of the story he just told about 8 burned babies and other atrocities he claims to have witnessed?
Mm-hmm. Well, briefly about Colonel Golan Vach. He grew up in Kiryat Arba, the most notorious as being one of the most racist settlements in the occupied West Bank. outside of Hebron. He grew up there, and his father was actually the mayor of the town. Growing up, he goes to the military academy called Bnei David, and at this academy, it is, you know, probably the most racist academy in the country, preparing Israeli soldiers and teaching them, if you can believe this, even preaching for the reestablishment of literal slavery, to actually enslave Palestinians literally. So this is his upbringing that he comes up with. And then in the army, he manages to become what you could say, in the words of the Israeli press, the most famous face of the Israeli army, because he headed for many years, including on October 7th, what's called Insarag heavy unit. So, you know, all over the world, every country has a kind of team that is like a crack team to come and help people who find themselves the victims of natural disasters. All over the world, these are secular teams, but in Israel, of course, for various reasons, this is a military team. Among other reasons, to give them the skills, and also for propaganda reasons, to make them kind of safety wash the atrocities of the army. So in any case, he's coming into October 7th as being in charge of this rescue unit. So on the day of October 7th, he gets to the killing fields of Kibbutz Be'eri and the Supernova Party. And his job, he will say, is to collect bodies. But what essentially was his job was twofold. One, he needed to help cover up the fact and whitewash the fact that Israeli forces had killed, you know, large amounts of their own civilians as part of the Hannibal directive to kill any possible Israeli who might be a hostage, so that you won't have to pay a political price later for their exchange. And so that day, as we have chronicled at the Electronic Intifada, that occurred many times, and Golan Bach's job was in part to cover that up. So, for example, he comes to Kibbutz Be'eri, and he comes to the house of Pesi Cohen, where it was the most amount of mass, or what they call mass Hannibal, the most amount of Hannibaled Israeli civilians to die in a single domicile. And in fact, 13 people died there. Between 9 and 10 of them died because the general in charge of the Israeli forces there said, you know, fire this tank at the house, even at the cost of civilian casualties. We just need to keep going and move forward. And it's not, you know, it's more important for us to conquer. And with that tank fire, they killed between 9 and 10 civilians, 7 of them by burning them to death. So at the end of this battle, we have Israeli bodies that have been, you know, also the bodies of Palestinian fighters, but dozens of bodies, including the bodies of Israeli civilians, that are completely immolated. And he now has to explain it. And so when the cameras of news outlets around the world converge on Kibbutz Be'eri exactly 1 week after the October 7th attacks, on October 14th, Golan Bach is taking VIP tours of dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of international reporters around the site and explaining what happened there and inventing atrocities that never occurred and inventing people that never occurred, infants that never lived. He just invented straight out of his own sick mind this idea that Palestinian fighters, who we know for a fact treated in that specific case, we know because there were Israelis who survived the ordeal, as you mentioned, Yasmin Porat, and told how she was treated humanely by her captors, and as were the people she was held captive with, that in fact, you know, the Israeli government, the Israeli army fired on these people, burnt them, and it wasn't, as I said, you know, it was just, he invented this story of now there were 8 babies there and Palestinian fighters burnt 8 babies and I took them out with my own hands. This was the first time, because you have to recall in the first few days afterwards, there were a few reports of people saying, yes, Israeli baby was butchered, Israeli baby was beheaded, Israeli baby was burned. But when press kind of pushed back, people retreated from that claim because it couldn't be substantiated because it never occurred. But then they found someone to say it. They put the face behind those evil words, those blood libels. And that face was the most famous face of the Israeli army. So therefore, the most likely to be believed. And so when he said it to all these countries, to all these international journalists, they believed it and they broadcast it. And this is how it held currency and still holds currency, because till this day, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whether he travels to the U.S. Congress, Washington, D.C., or whether he speaks at the United Nations in New York City, he is repeating these blood libels over and over again, these stories that never existed, purely on the basis of the claims of this liar, Colonel Golan Vah, who invented these six stories for two reasons. One, to cover up the harm that Israel had done to its own citizens, and also, of course, to incite the genocide that followed. And he did this, as we showed in our the investigation that was published a year ago in June. We showed how he did this in Be'eri. But then in this new reporting that just came out last week, we're also showing how he did the same thing at the Supernova Festival, how he invented other atrocity hoaxes. Amongst the atrocity hoaxes he invented, he claims that Palestinian fighters created a bonfire of 120 Israeli civilians and burned them all in one big pyre. Just absolute atrocity hoax. Never occurred, nothing even remotely close to that. Not even in any way, shape, or form. Okay, it's the same thing. He said that around 100 Israeli women were raped. He describes 100 Israeli women tied to trees in the Supernova party area. Again, absolute lies, no basis in reality whatsoever. The most atrocious lies imaginable in order to incite genocide. Now, what we also show in the new investigation is, I've basically just given you the importance of what Golan Vah did, but as we show in the new article published last week, he got to not only incite that genocide, but then participate in it and lead it, if you can imagine that. The people that, perpetuated these lies that ended up, being used to manufacture consent for the annihilation of the Gaza Strip and Palestinian life there, then enabled those very same Israeli officers to be at the forefront, the vanguard of the destruction of Palestinian life in the Gaza Strip. So the way that it can most easily be understood is the so-called Netzarim axis, okay, which is basically a highway that Israel built of destruction to bisect the entire Gaza Strip. And this was created of a certain width, but then once the Israeli brother, the younger brother of Golan Vah, but of a higher rank.
Thank you, David. Maybe spell out for us. You say that obviously Golan Vah played a key role. He was the face of Israel's atrocity propaganda and lies, telling these fabricated stories about burned babies and bonfires of Israelis, which is all spelled out in your newest article. Mm-hmm. And then you say he went into Gaza and he was particularly focused on the so-called Netzarim axis, or Netzarim corridor, as we've often called it in this live stream. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned his brothers. Your mm-hmm. article is called the Vah brothers, the first family of genocide. So why don't you tell us, so there's Golan Vah, tell us who his brothers are and what they all did in Gaza once the genocide began.
Okay. So it's also worth mentioning that Barak Hiram, the general who led Israeli forces, who gave the order to shoot that tank at the House of Pesikon in Be'eri that resulted in the torching, the immolation of all these Israeli civilians, that was also one of the people who then led the genocide. So his name, again, Barak Hiram, head of the 99th Division. So basically the Netzarim Junction, the forces that occupied it and who mercilessly killed Palestinian civilians who lived in it and passed through it for the last year and a half. So those, it was basically a number of Israeli fighting units that went one after the other and, you know, completed that mission of obliterating Palestinian life there. That task was shared by both Barak Hiram, the general from Be'eri, and Yehuda Vach, who was the brother of Golan Vach, the rescue chief and inciter of blood libels. But his younger brother, Yehuda Vach, also a brigadier general, he heads the 252nd Division. So the 99th of Barak Hiram and the 252nd of Yehuda Vach, they have traded places and occupied that Netzarim corridor. And we have quotes that were brought from the article by Haaretz, by Yaniv Kubovich, who interviewed Israeli soldiers who came back to the front and described what they saw there from their experience, that there was a competition between units who could kill the most civilians, and other horrible atrocities that went on that are quoted in the article. But what Yehuda did as the overall commander in charge, he brought in his brothers. And what his brother Golan Vach of blood libel fame, what he did was he became essentially what they called the demolitions contractor of the Gaza Strip. Okay, so he utilized the skill sets that, you know, he specialized in for serving in this, you know, United Nations recognized rescue unit. And those same technologies and contacts and skill sets he used in order to increase the amount of destruction in Gaza. And Haaretz reporting describes, you know, based on these soldiers who were there, saying that they built up buildings that served no military purpose, that could not have threatened them in any way, shape, or form. It was all about destruction, because these men, again, studied Ad Bnei Eli, want the genocide to occur, want non-Jews to be genocided from the country. And so they did everything they could to do that, including even going beyond the regular rules of the army, as if the army's war plans weren't brutal enough. So it's alleged in the article that the Vach brothers, Yehuda Vach bringing in his brothers, that they essentially ramped up the genocide. And lots of quotes from the article explaining how that happened. The third, the younger of the three, Captain Elisha Vach, he also served and took part in the annihilation of Gaza. But what's his role is more on the outside, because he has been part of a NGO group, that movement that he started to force the Israeli government to become even more brutal. From his perspective and the perspective of his political camp, they believe that it's not genocidal enough, that, you know, in their words, let us win. They, you know, he co-authored a letter complaining to the Israeli military chief of staff, saying, you know, we, the undersigned, you know, soldiers in this and this and this unit, are upset because we are being hamstrung, and, you know, you're not allowing us to kill as wantonly as we want to. So please, you know, allow us to do so by changing the rules and making even, you know, even more barbaric, essentially. I'm paraphrasing, of course. So on the outside, he has been leading this pressure, you know, this pressure group, and they camped out outside the home of Israel's defense minister. And on TV, you saw them, you know, the host of Israeli national television, you know, like cheering him on. Yeah, good for you that you're doing this. And, you know, he's treated like a national hero for demanding that the genocide be even more vicious than it already is. So that basically gives you the tripartite Vach brothers and just a little bit of what each of them have done to make the genocide even worse. Yeah. Of course, some people would say, as in the Haaretz article, they would claim these guys are operating like a rogue unit in right. The Israeli army. It's not the Israeli army, you know, decision makers who are responsible for this. It's just Vach and his cohorts. And but please,
not an
since
operation.
This time, they're constantly meeting with the defense minister, the army chief of staff, continue to get their approval. The younger brother, Elisha Vach, is praised by Israel's chief rabbi. Of course, Golan Vach himself, the original blood libeler who got the whole ball rolling, I mean, he flies all around the world. You know, the Jewish agency, the you know, the proto-state organization that is responsible for so much of the colonization of the country and dispossession of Palestinians. So the Jewish agency is, you know, funding, you know, his appearances all over the world, you know, so that he can repeat the lies that he spoke after October 7th. And of course, to use that, those stories, those atrocities that he invented to convince local Jews to abandon the countries that they live in and to immigrate to Israel, to be part of Israel's demographic war and to, you know, inherit the territories that, you know, that he's now helping to conquer. Completely. So that's the Vach family, if you can imagine. That's why we call them the first family of genocide.
David, let's talk a little bit about how internally within, you know, the Israeli press, you know, what the pushback looks like against, you know, these kinds of just disgusting lies that the Vach family are perpetrating. Let's look at another video of the Israeli journalist Israel Fry.
יום הזיכרון 2025, אני מבקש להקדיש לזכר 8 תינוקות שנשרפו באכזריות בשביל אוקטובר בקיבוץ בארי.
רגע, רציתי להביא את התמונות של התינוקות. איך קוראים להם? האם זה בכלל קרה? בואו נקשיב למה שסיפרו קציני צה"ל בכירים על מה שהתרחש בבית של פסיקו.
So that's the Israeli journalist Israel Frey. He posted that video last week for Israel's so-called Memorial Day. And he starts off saying, quote, I would like to dedicate to the 8 babies that were brutally burned on October 7th in Kibbutz Be'eri. But if you watch the rest of the video, you know, you can quickly understand that he's being sarcastic. He says he looked for the photos and the names of the babies, but he couldn't find them because they don't exist, like you said, David. And that incident never happened. So basically, he covers the same ground that we have in our reporting. Talk about the significance of an Israeli journalist talking about this in Hebrew. Is this common and is it dangerous?
Yeah, very much so. So first of all, just to kind of frame what we're looking at, you know, a poll came out just a little while ago in recent weeks, and we found that the percentage of Israeli Jews who have a moral problem with what the Israeli army is doing in the Gaza Strip is 3%. So that means amongst Israeli Jews, for every one that thinks that what's going on is immoral, there's 32 Israeli Jews who do not think that there's any moral problem with what's going on in the Gaza Strip. So that means that, sadly, sickeningly, you're constantly surrounded in society by, you know, people who support genocide. It also means that one out of every 33 of them doesn't. And amongst them, there's a small percentage who have the courage or find the courage to resist and speak out. And in the case of this specific journalist, Israel Frey, he has the courage to do so in Hebrew. And because he does so, of course, he is very much comes under threat. For example, the very week right after October 7th, that Sabbath, he, you know, put out a call calling for the end of any Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. And he was immediately set upon, you know, by massive mobs who shot fireworks at his apartment, you know, in all hours of the night, masses of people haranguing him, and the cops wouldn't help him, and he had to flee to a hidden location from which he lives to this day. So he continues to report, that wasn't his only time doing so, he continues to report on Palestinian issues in 48 Israel and other issues of injustice. And but as I said, he's one of those few voices, the few rare ones that do. And because he is, he obviously, you know, it comes under threat. But also, I mean, you have to realize that anyone who does so, it's not only just the mob mentality. You know, Israel passed a law in January making it illegal you know, punishable by 5 years in jail if you dare to say something that's against the state narrative about what allegedly occurred and didn't occur on October 7th, 2023. So, I mean, Israel has already been brought in by the police, accused of incitement to terrorism, you know, and he's been interrogated. So it's not clear. Already there's, you know, a cloud of suspicion on him from the streets, from the police, and, you know, with obviously the, you know, state forces cracking down inside 48 on any kind of free discourse and discussion about what's going on, it's going to be pressure on people to, you know, to completely, you know, to be completely silent about it. So he's taking some risk. In terms of how that's, you know, his word is being received in Israeli society, let's just say that in recent weeks, of course, we've seen protests in the streets, Israelis coming out and demanding the end to the war. But the people who come to those protests are interested in the main in the end of the war so that there can be Israeli hostages repatriated back to Israel. They're not interested in the end of the war because it's the cause of the death of, you know, thousands of Palestinian, tens of thousands of Palestinian children. In fact, at these protests, when there is a small minority of people who aren't just, you know, holding up the yellow ribbons for the hostages, but have other signs that say, you know, stop the genocide or whatever relating to the deaths of Palestinian children, then you have the parents of those hostages coming on the microphone and saying, we don't want you. We don't want you here. This is only for the hostages. We don't want any signs about Palestinian children. This isn't about the Palestinian children. In one case, a mother of one of the hostages comes and rips the signs out of their hands. So, you know, the few Israelis who from minute one were calling for a hostage deal, which would have been in the best interests, of course, of Israeli civilians, they are, you know, and only later, you know, hostage families started to organize, and only later did they start to have the chutzpah to say, okay, well, maybe we should oppose the government policy and demand that the government prioritize the return of our children. So these Johnny-come-latelys, who are the families of the actual victims, are, you know, they're mad because if their protest smells a little bit leftist, then it'll drive even more racist Israelis away from the camp that's calling for the end of, you know, a ceasefire of some sorts. So they're worried about losing the vast majority of Israelis who don't, you know, from their perspective, the war should be eternal. And so therefore, they're, you know, the few people who were the first ones to call for an end to war are being, you know, signs ripped from their hand, and of course arrested at protests. Here in Haifa, we saw police arresting protesters who are protesting against the war. The few who show up, with the minute they pull out a sign that's anti-genocide, the minute they start chanting something, boom, police comes in, takes them to a car, and that's the end of the story. So very, very, very little pushback against the genocide in Jewish Israeli society.
And you're in Haifa, which is known as a mixed city, which is a polite way of saying that not all the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed when the Zionist settler colony was established. What about Palestinians there? I mean, we know, we've seen many, many stories of Palestinians being arrested simply for Facebook posts. What can you say about the situation in the city where you live? Mm-hmm. You mentioned the arrests of protests, but is there a general fear about speaking out, even on social media? How does it work there?
Sure. Well, because Haifa is far from the 67 area, so you don't have some of the same concerns that, say, the Jerusalemites might have, because they're more liable to pass some kind of checkpoint where they would have to potentially submit their mobile phones and then be subject to a search of their social media. So here in Haifa, you wouldn't really worry about someone encountering you in the streets. Just to put it in perspective, when we talk about mixed cities, you know, historically for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, Haifa has been a mixed city. It was a multicultural Muslim city coming into the 20th century. In 1947, it was 50-50 at that point, Jews had colonized it to the point where it was 50% Jewish, 50% Palestinian. And after the Nakba, it became 90%+ Jewish. So since that time, it's been just about the same. So when we talk about mixed city, I just don't want people to think 50-50. We're talking about today about 12% Palestinian, something like that. In any case,
which is remarkable because in Israeli propaganda, Haifa is always presented as this model of coexistence, which of course Israel doesn't want, because if they wanted coexistence, then you wouldn't have to have like a Jewish supremacist state. You could just have coexistence, but yeah.
I mean, Haifa is, I'm not going to lie. I mean, the reason why I live here is because in 48 territories, it's from my perspective, the best possible world, you know, not only the natural beauty, you know, seeing as we are right here on the Mediterranean from my apartment, I can see all the way to Acre on a clear day. So besides the natural beauty of the city, the fact that there is, I will just say that it's maybe of the very few mixed cities, so-called mixed cities, where you have both, where it's not just 90% Jewish or 90% or more Palestinian, it's the one of the maybe handful of places where it's mixed. So here you actually have in the city center a Palestinian middle class that's strong economically. And I think that more than anything is what sets the vibe up. So it can create a space because it's, you know, the Palestinians are firmly rooted now financially in the city to create a culture in which people can tap into it. But of course, anyone who I talk to is just, you know, has their heads down. Of course, there's a little bit of political activity there. As I mentioned, there are protests every couple weeks against the war, but they're treated with zero tolerance. And it's only a few dozen people who show up, unfortunately. People are, you know, naturally, they're thinking of their own finances. I know, of course, people who are also leaving. I saw this more amongst Jewish citizens on the left side of the political spectrum, but I'm starting to see it also now in the Palestinian community of people themselves leaving or their children are leaving. It's certainly a phenomenon. People are, this isn't a way to live, and it's gotten only worse since October 7th, even in the 48 territories.
And that's an issue we've discussed with Shir Hever and others, sort of the longer term brain drain. And of course, now the aerial blockade that makes traveling in and out of Lid Airport more and more difficult. That being the original name for what Israel now calls Ben Gurion Airport. But David, just before we let you go, just to bring it back to some of the incredible journalism that you are doing, and that we're very happy to publish at the Electronic Intifada. You know, one could despair almost that these lies continue to propagate, the lies about burned babies and all the other atrocity propaganda. And as you said, the discussion is there in Israel. It's probably there more than it is in the United States. I mean, many of our sources in our reporting, if not all of them, are Israeli sources. So this is present in Israel, even if it's somewhat on the margins. But what do you think, what do you hope the impact of your work will be now and in the future? What's the point of spending so much time and effort debunking Israel's October 7 lies?
Well, you know, it's... I guess what you're asking a kind of a personal question, what, you know, in a sense, you know, how are you personally motivated to do this work? I mean, I noticed it, you know, it was my job. I was working on the Al Jazeera film about what did and didn't happen October 7th. That came out in March, very soon after the Israeli government made Al Jazeera's work illegal in the country. While working on this project, I came to realize of these lies. And once you have this information, it's like, okay, I just need to preserve my brain long enough until this can get down on paper or onto bits and bytes and zeros and ones, until it can be out there. It's important to that people know this. And sadly, it's, you know, it's super frustrating because, you know, this, the stuff around Al Jazeera came out in March of last year. The article we first published about Golan Bach in Electronic Intifada, that came out in June. So optimally, if people would have been horrified, you know, at that point, then Yehuda Vach would have never been able to replace Barak Hiram in the Netzarim Junction and all the destruction that he and his brothers were then responsible for exacerbating wouldn't have occurred. I mean, of course, it doesn't, you know, do anything about all of the destruction that did occur, but it, I realized that, like, seriously, if one of these articles would have gone viral outside of, you know, small pro-Palestinian circles, then it could have changed how things went down. And so, of course, it's frustrating, but I cannot allow the measure of whether I do this work be based on if I managed to get a million views or if it managed to crack the mainstream media, because then the work wouldn't happen. You know, it has to happen. So you can't depend upon that to be motivated. I don't lack for motivation. What's right is right and wrong is wrong. If I need extra motivation, which I don't, I think about my own grandparents who went through the Holocaust and lost dozens of members of their families. And I am horrified at the thought that people will legitimately start. I mean, it's, of course, it's illegitimate to say, but it's logical to understand why they would start to say, well, if these Jews made up all these horrific atrocities, well, it was just that Jew and that Jew. Well, it's the head of the army unit that did it. And then it was the prime minister of the country and the president of the country and the Democratic majority, you know, in the United States who repeated these ad nauseum. And then people are going to say, well, if the mainstream Israel and Israel in power supported these atrocious lies, then what's not to say that the horrors of the Holocaust weren't invented and there was no genocide of the Jews by Nazi Germany? So if anything, you know, if I which I don't, but if anything, that I, you know, can that motivate me to be like, all the more reason why this needs to come out. So no one can afterward could say, oh, people tried to sweep it. Well, yeah, sickeningly, people did try to sweep this under the rug. And sickeningly, the rest of the Israeli media has completely ignored this. And they've been afraid, even on the left side of spectrum of the media, they've been afraid to challenge the Israeli government's narrative about October 7th for fear, again, of losing the mainstream, you know, which they'll never receive anyways, because the mainstream is already so skewed to the far right. But in doing so, they've completely, you know, put me at risk and put the name of Jewish people at risk for eternity by making the official state of the Jews out to be the biggest blood libelers of the 21st century. So I don't need to, you know, I wake up in the morning and I've got work to do, and we do it because we have to do it. And if I happen to be here at this particular corner where I'm able to make a difference, great. Everyone does their part, you know.
Well, you certainly have made a difference, and you are making a difference, David. I'm very proud of the investigations we've done about what happened on October 7th and revealing many of the lies. And our work has stood the test of time, because the more that comes out, the more it's clear that we were right about some of the things we said very early on and before many other people dared to say them. And we're very grateful to you, because your work has been critically important in that. And I want to remind people that your most recent article for the Electronic Intifada was published just at the end of April, and it's called The Vach Brothers, Israel's First Family of Genocide. And I highly recommend reading that and all your other work. You also have a website. What's your website, David?
It's just davidsheen.com, just my name, and it should be right there on screen.
And you're also active on social media, and I know that all your social media accounts are linked from your website too, as well as in your articles at the Electronic Intifada. So thank you for joining us, David. It took a long time to get you on the live stream, but it won't hopefully take as long a time to get you back. And we're very, very grateful to you for joining us today.